Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're talking about bipeds, bipedalism. And this is a topic that I was just kind of rattling around in my brain the other day. Because for most of us, walking is just kind of every day, right? You run a little bit. Maybe you hop a little bit. It's, of course, evolved multiple times in mammals. You have macropods, kangaroo, rats, and mice, spring hare, hopping mice, pangolins, and, of course, hominid apes, which includes ourselves. Mm-hmm. And sometimes scientists make the distinction between facultative and obligate bipeds, though this isn't a standard distinction. Suffice to say, there are creatures such as the human, flightless birds, and to draw on a prehistoric example, the T-Rex, that have no real alternative to bipedal movement.
I mean, I can crab walk around.
Yeah, well, no. If you're crab walking, you're still bipedal, unless you can grow some crab legs. It depends which version of the crab walker you're talking. You're talking about where you're...
I'm talking where, you lean back and you go on all fours with your belly up in the air.
Because there's also the Zoidberg walk, where you walk from side to side a squat.
That's a good one, but that's not what I meant.
Yeah, that would just be bipedal. Zoidberg is a biped.
No. I meant the exorcist down the stairs walk.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, that would count.
But I fully grant you, I probably wouldn't get around very quickly doing that all the time.
Other creatures, of course, are capable of bipedal locomotion, but only employ it under certain circumstances. Like, for instance, a lemur dancing, sort of prancing sideways across a clearing between two trees. A giant ground sloth in olden days rising up to reach higher branches. Or one of my favorites, a cat standing on its hind legs to better view prey or something of interest. This is always a creepy, weird sight if you're lucky enough to witness it.
Oh, but it also can be very cute.
Yes.
When dogs stand on two legs to get up there closer to the treat that they want.
Oh, yeah.
It's adorable.
When dogs do it, it's adorable. When cats do it, it's a little unsettling.
Right.
Like they've suddenly become tiny people, like they've been people all along. Or that's my read on it. Now, when it comes to the hominins, which again includes humans, the oldest evidence of bipedal movement in a hominin species was probably 6 million years ago. This would have been the Sahelanthropus. And there's some dispute over this. But at any rate, we were mostly bipedal by, say, 4 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We had a curved spine by 2.5 million years ago, and it altered our hip support by 1.95 million years ago. And we were fully bipedal by the time of Homo erectus, with signature pelvis and thigh bones evident in the fossil record. The legs lengthened over time, allowing for longer strides, everything that would enable the Ministry of Silly Walks to do its thing.
Yeah. Now, some of what we know about the posture and gait of our ancient ancestors and their close relatives has to be inferred indirectly. I mean, you can get a pretty good idea from like the shapes of bones
right.
and stuff. That'll tell you a lot. There's other evidence that's very direct. A great piece of early direct evidence for bipedality is the fossil formation known as the Laetoli footprints. So, Robert, have you seen what these look like?
I think I have. Yeah. Let's refresh everybody.
Very cool. In 1976, there was a team working with the paleontologist Mary Leakey, mm-hmm. and they discovered a collection of fossilized animal tracks in Laetoli, Tanzania, which is south of the Olduvai Gorge. And the tracks were preserved in what had been a soft bed of volcanic ash about 3.6 million years ago, or 3.7. And it had hardened and been preserved for us to discover in the 20th century. And then so after these tracks were initially discovered in 1978, Paul Abel, a colleague of Leakey's, discovered that the formation also contained a 27-meter or about 88-foot-long trail of ancient hominin footprints in addition to the other animal footprints, probably made by Australopithecus afarensis, the species to which Lucy belonged. And there were about 70 hominin footprints in all in this formation. And so the thing about these footprints is they're quite clearly bipedal. You know, you're not seeing four-legged movement. Somebody was just walking on 2 feet mm-hmm. through this volcanic ash. The prints I've read are spaced close together, meaning a short stride might mean short legs. And the prints also show a big toe in line with the foot rather than opposed to the foot as you see in arboreal apes. So like, you know, your human big toes go straight out. The arboreal apes have more kind of a toe thumb, like a big toe thumb, that they use to climb trees and grab hold of stuff. And also their footfalls apparently went heel toe, just like ours tend to. Mm-hmm. So by about 3.6 million years ago, we've got direct evidence that our ancestors and their close relatives were walking on 2 feet. And I also can't help but mention I've read supposedly there's this story of how the prints were discovered because one of Leakey's colleagues, a paleoanthropologist named Andrew Hill, stumbled across the fossil formation when he and another colleague were running around throwing elephant poop at each other.
Oh, well, you know, you got to keep it lighthearted on the dig, right? So like you said, we know all of this based on mostly fossil remains. And by this, you know, we're looking at the bones of our ancestors and observing what the gradual shift to bipedalism did to us. And it certainly came at a cost.
Yeah.
Now, to be sure, it was worth it, I guess. I mean, it made it easier for us to pick up fruits and pick from low-lying branches. It gave us free hands for carrying food and also, very importantly, carrying tools. Carrying our young as well. It allowed us to rise up and appear larger and more fearsome to our enemies, our many enemies of the wild. This is something that I think we often don't think about, but unless you're being instructed on how to react to a bear in the wild, mm-hmm. you know, they say make yourself as big as possible.
Right.
And certainly there are other animals that do just the same thing. But that's one of the strengths of being able to at least rise up on 2 feet.
Yeah. Now, you can't know this for sure, but I tend to think that bipedalism is a sort of necessary precursor to advanced tool-using intelligence. I mean, you see some use of tools in quadrupedal apes, mm-hmm. but the fact that you're walking on 2 feet gives you free hands, and having free hands, it seems like suddenly you've got much more incentive to be using them for all kinds of stuff.
Well, it's interesting when you think about the animals that do display some form of tool use. I mean, mm-hmm. certainly you have the apes, which are going to more or less align with the human experience of tool use. But then, mm-hmm. of course, you have like the corvids mm-hmm. and a few other birds that also use tools. Now, obviously, they are engaging in bipedal ground movement. Mm-hmm. Their wings are tucked away. But it's perhaps – I mean, it's a slightly different situation with birds because those wings do have a purpose. Mm-hmm. They've just specialized their beak functionality and have learned how to use tools with that.
Yeah.
The same is true of dolphins. You know, they're using – when they engage in tool use, they're using their snout. Octopi, slightly different situation. they have a wide variety of limbs and are not necessarily going to become bipedal anytime soon. So any way you shake it, though, back to the human scenario, it helped us expand our range. It definitely played a part in our ascension, our dominance, certainly our ability to invent things and expand. But we also paid a price. We had to distribute all of our weights on two limbs, resulting in all sorts of painful experiences, such as lower back pain, slipped discs, arthritis in the lower body, fallen arches. Our spines are ultimately just kind of weird. We evolved wider hips and stronger knees to kind of cope with it to a certain extent, but this is the reason that roughly 80% of adult humans will experience back pain in their lives.
I would say one of the biggest anatomical drawbacks is that we can make finger guns at each other. I mean, that is a true blow to the species.
You mean the beneficial kind, or like kids playing cowboys and Indians or whatever on the playground?
No, the catch you later, bro.
Oh, okay. So it also affected the way that we give birth. And this is I have to say, this is a topic that we could easily have devoted an entire episode to. There's a lot of scholarship and debate on exactly how the modern human birthing scenario pans out towards prehistoric examples. Mm-hmm. But the move toward the bipedal form changed our skeletons. This affected the pelvis. Most primates have a pretty straight birth canal, but hominins soon boasted a narrow, distorted kind of funhouse tube of a birth canal. The offspring had to twist and turn in order to pass through. This was true of our ancestors. But our bodies continued to evolve. We became taller. We grew larger brains. That meant bigger-brained babies having to make it through that twisting tunnel. Everything became tighter. Childbirth became a potentially more dangerous affair because it also means giving birth to a child at an earlier stage of its development in order to actually break it free from the confines of our bipedally twisted bodies. Now, again, there's a lot more to this. Scientists have gone back and forth on the so-called obstetric dilemma, but bipedal evolution certainly changed things.
Yeah. All right, I think we should take a quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss why bipedalism evolved in humans.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
All right, we're back. So this is a big question because certainly we can point to all of these, the pros and all the cons, but like what is the driving force, right?
Right. What caused our ancient hominin ancestors to go on two legs primarily? Why did our ancestors become bipedal? And this is an ongoing debate. We know at some point we transitioned from mostly four-footed gait to a mostly two-footed gait, but why did it happen and what type of pressure selected for this? So first of all, when answering questions like this, it's often hard to be certain, right? You know, we only have the evidence we can find. Fossil evidence helps, but it's hard to like run new experiments to test this. We only have the fossil finds we have and can only draw the conclusions we can draw from them. And there have been all kinds of answers over the years. So for a long time, consensus seemed to be that bipedalism was an adaptation to a change in our primary habitat. As our ancestors moved down out of the trees into a flat grassland, perhaps driven by changing climate, like changing climate killed off forests and left these, you know, savannas with tall grasses in their place, or these creatures just moved down into the savannas to follow food sources or something. In this case, these hominins needed to stand up to see over the tall grass. And this explanation is not still favored. This has fallen out of favor among experts. And one reason is that climate history analysis and physical fossil evidence indicate that we were becoming bipedal at the same time that we were still adapted to climbing and living in trees. And I think there are multiple lines of evidence supporting this. It appears that at some point our ancestors were both like living in forests and climbing trees, but also having skeletons that support a bipedal walking gait. Also, it's worth pointing out that plenty of other animals that occupy areas with tall grasslands, do just fine staying on all fours, right? Mm-hmm. They don't need to stand up to see over the grass in order to survive. Like grassland baboons today are still quadrupedal. So that used to be what people thought, but that is no longer the main hypothesis. So another theory that is popular with the public but not with scientists in the relevant fields is the much beloved aquatic ape theory.
Oh, yes. We talked about this last year.
Yeah, in our aquatic humanoids episode. Mm-hmm. We concluded that there's not really any good evidence for this. There's no direct fossil evidence for it whatsoever. And the indirect reasoning that causes people to think that there's evidence for this is it's just not very good. But we should mention it because this is bound to come up whenever people address bipedality right. And its origins. I think it's just because it's fun to imagine maybe and because it's unconventional that makes it more interesting to people. Basically, it says that the explanation for the main phenotypic variations between us and our closest ape relatives is that our direct ancestors briefly evolved to become water-dwelling primates, mm-hmm. So sort of like fishmen, and then moved back to dry land after that. And under this theory, bipedality evolves because we need to keep our heads above water when we're wading around in search of shellfish for food.
Right. It would be kind of like the idea that we became bipedal because we didn't want to get our t-shirts wet, you know?
I mean, it's not that bad, but yeah. So this was first proposed by Alistair Hardy, and it was mainly developed by somebody named Elaine Morgan. And in short, Morgan says, look, we're the only mammal that consistently walks on two legs, but some four-legged animals can occasionally stand up on two legs. And when do our closest ape relatives walk on two legs? Well, she claims there's only one circumstance when they always walk on two legs, and that's when they're wading in water. I see some pretty clear evidence running counter to this assertion just in publicly available video. Like primates, you look this up. Primates sometimes stand up on two legs for all kinds of reasons, while carrying objects and moving around with them, during dominance displays, to reach something. Like they don't – and they also, on top of that, don't always stand up when wading in water. I found video of gorillas wading around in water, and they tend to stay on all fours. So if the classic explanation about seeing over the grass is probably wrong, and we don't put any stock in the aquatic ape, what is the real explanation? Of course, we still don't know, but there are a lot of competing theories. Maybe there was a selection pressure on having free hands. So maybe some of our ancestors began carrying or throwing things, and for some reason this got started, and then there was a great survival or reproduction advantage for the ones that did this more and more of the time.
So being able – this comes back to the examples of being able to carry one's young, being able to carry food that you've gathered, or being able to carry a tool or a weapon. Say a nice jawbone for smacking the other ape creatures around.
Well, a big one I've seen suggested actually is throwing. Mm-hmm. Like if we evolved somehow a throwing hunting strategy where you would throw objects, mm-hmm. that this could have spurred bipedality or some bridge to it. Mm. Another thing I was reading about in a BBC article is that recent research has suggested that perhaps partial bipedality helped these hominins adapt to rocky, uneven terrain in geologically active areas. Essentially, that our ancestors were not only tree climbers but rock climbers, and this encouraged them to take on some traits that bridge the gap to bipedalism.
Interesting.
Another is, I guess, sort of the least least interesting as an idea, but seems to have a lot going for it, and it's simply that a certain kind of bipedalism in tree-dwelling life became useful, as it is in many orangutans today. Like mm-hmm. you can look at orangutans living in the trees that walk around on 2 feet. Like they'll reach up and grab branches with their arms over their heads while walking around on other branches with 2 feet.
Yeah, it's just a great way to anchor yourself between a lower and upper branch.
So there are a lot of competing theories. I mean, I know there are other ones we didn't even cover here, but this is an unsolved question. We still don't know the answer.
Now, any way you shake it, we were not the first bipeds.
No.
Not by a long shot.
Not even close.
I already mentioned the T-Rex, you know, the famous Cretaceous period carnivore. Cretaceous period, of course, spanned 145 million years ago to 66 million years ago. And this, again, is just an animal that could scarcely be more of a biped, you know, with those tiny little arms. And, of course, he or she is just one of the many theropods that roamed the prehistoric Earth. And in many cases, not just roamed it, but ran after their prey, running a key advantage of their bipedal morphology. But even they, it seems, were not the first. There is a 290 million-year-old fossil of a species that is dubbed Udibamus cursorus. This is a creature that was very lizard-like, it seems, in its probable appearance. Had short forelimbs, relatively long tail, and also relatively long hind limbs. So these are kind of the hallmarks of a bipedal creature. But the other curious thing about it is that it seems to have been an herbivore rather than a meat eater like the theropods.
Hmm.
Therefore, it probably paleontologists think it probably depended on bipedal running to flee from quadrupedal danger.
Okay.
And on the subject of dinosaurs and quadrupedal and bipedal arrangement, I found a 2005 article in Astrobiology magazine that brings up a species that is dubbed Massospondylus. And this is a prosauropod.
Hmm.
Now, sauropods, as everyone remember, they're the giant Diplodocus, Brachiosaurus style kind of creatures. You know, big, enormous quadrupeds, just enormous, just ponderous creatures. The prosauropods, unlike their descendants, they could rise up on their hind legs and go after food bipedally. So back in 2005, University of Toronto at Mississauga, that's UTM, biology professor Robert Rice, he looked at an embryo of one of these mesospondylus creatures, and he found, you know, the thing was that it looked like a four-legged sauropod. So he hypothesized that it would have grown into a full bipedal form as it matured. This is what he told Astrobiology magazine. Quote, because the embryo of Mesospondylus looks like a tiny sauropod with massive limbs and a quadrupedal gait, we proposed in our paper that the sauropod's gait probably evolved through a phenomenon called pedomorphosis, the retention of embryonic and juvenile features in the adult. So this is interesting because we're talking about a creature that potentially adapted bipedal the bipedal gait, but then left it behind. Pedomorphosis, by the way, it's something we see today in various amphibian species. But for these sauropods, for the true sauropods, it would mean that they were essentially man babies of the prehistoric world. Like they simply no longer had to grow up. Like they were the biggest forest-eating dumpsters on the planet. And therefore, they really didn't have to augment their more or less larval form anymore.
You know, I have often wondered something. When looking at bipedal theropod dinosaurs like the T-Rex, just look at that powerful lower body and then the tiny little baby arms out front. If this dinosaur fell down or even just, you know, went to have a little lie down in the meadow, how did it get back up? I'm not saying it would be impossible. It just seems very awkward. Of course, we're bipedal and we can get up from the ground, but we have long arms and strong upper bodies to help us. Try lying down on the ground and then getting up without using your arms at all. You can probably do it, but it's not so easy, is it? And the T-Rex probably has an even lower relative center of mass than you. So what's going on? Like, was it this much of a struggle for the T-Rex every time it had to get up from the ground?
That's a great question.
Well, I've been wondering this for a while. I finally looked it up. There's actually a really good explainer on this in Scientific American provided by the paleontologist Gregory M. Erickson of Florida State University. And so here's what Erickson says. First of all, there has long been a dispute over exactly what the T-Rex's tiny forelimbs were for. Maybe, you know, one idea says maybe they're just vestigial, meaning they're actually not good for much of anything at all, and they only existed in diminished form because the Rex hadn't fully lost them yet. And then the next idea says, well, maybe they're grasping arms used in copulation. And then the next idea says, maybe there's some sort of meat hook for feeding chunks of flesh into the mouth, though this hypothesis was beaten down when it became clear that the arms of a T-Rex could not reach its mouth.
Yeah, this is one of those things that when we went to the museum in Chicago, the Field Museum, that became obvious. When you go up to the arm, the fossil bones of a T-Rex's arm, they are the size of my arm. But the T-Rex is the size of like a two-story house. And clearly, this is a shrunken limb.
Exactly. But another hypothesis is that the baby arms were useful exactly for helping the T-Rex get back up when it was lying on the ground. So in the year 1970, the British paleontologist Barney Newman speculated that maybe the arms could help the T-Rex do a thing kind of like a push-up. It would be a push-up motion where it would help the Rex keep from sliding forward along the ground as it tried to raise its body to a standing position. Just imagine trying to rise without anything to brace you, like lie flat on your stomach and then try to push yourself up to standing using your legs alone. You might be able to do it, but it's not easy. It's a lot easier if you can use your arms.
Right, and it requires a fair amount of sort of coiling and slithering around for most people, I think. And it's easier to imagine that kind of movement in our bodies as opposed to the T-Rex.
Yes. So Erickson says, you know, now we know more about the biomechanics of the T-Rex than we did back when these ideas were hypothesized. So, of course, number one, as we mentioned, the arms can't reach the mouth. So the meat hook theory, that's dead. One thing we have learned is that T-Rex arms were often broken during life as opposed to in an injury that immediately caused death. And this tells us some interesting things. First of all, it tells us that the arms were probably kind of bad at whatever the Rexes were using them for. And number two, they were not absolutely necessary for survival. The fact that we could have like examples of them having healed or not immediately killed the Rex means that a Rex could break an arm and survive for at least a month afterward. Mm. If an animal in the wild breaks a survival essential limb, that animal is generally pretty much done for.
Right. Like a cheetah breaking a leg, et cetera. It's done.
And this suggests four limbs that were not survival essential. Also, though the Rex arms would have been strong by our standards, like he says they could probably curl 400 pounds, they would not have had strong enough bone structure in the wrists to lift what he calls large mechanical loads, and that would include the Rex's own body. So this means Newman's push-up hypothesis is probably wrong, right? That the T-Rex did a push-up in order to get up from the ground. So how did they get up once they were lying down? Well, Erickson suggests looking to birds who get up without the aid of four limbs. And apparently what they do is they simply tuck their legs directly underneath their center of gravity and then push straight up. Actually, probably sort of the exact same thing you would do if you tried to stand up from the ground without using your arms. You try to gather your legs under you and then push up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But also, theropod dinosaurs with tiny arms, like the T-Rex, would have had the aid of their tails to help gain additional leverage or bracing against the ground. So the way I'm imagining this, I could be wrong, but it's the same way you would brace your hands against the ground in front of you while extending your legs to stand up. Imagine a T-Rex maybe being able to brace its tail against the ground behind it while pushing up with its legs, a sort of backward standing.
Hmm. You know, all of this, I think it's just another reminder that the T-Rex, one of the most famous dinosaurs, if not the most famous dinosaur, the specimen out there, and also one that we know a fair amount about. There are a number of fossils that have been found, and yet there's so much that we do not know about the T-Rex. Mm-hmm. There are things about it that we will never know unless we get that time machine to go back and start hunting them. Or we somehow bring them back to life with a Jurassic Park scenario.
I propose a preemptive ban on dinosaur hunting. Before we have any time machines, we've got to get the regulations in place.
That's right. We got to think ahead of our technology. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
All right, we're back. All right, so one of the big questions I had, too, in all of this is, all right, we've looked at bipeds in prehistoric times. We look at the bipedal world around us that the humans have built. We're always trying to figure out what's going on or what could be going on other worlds, what other kinds of life have evolved, are evolving, or will evolve in the future. So,
assuming the entire universe isn't dead.
Right.
Other than us, which, you know, might be.
Right. So, what's the deal? Would we find legged creatures on other worlds? And if we did, would we find bipedal creatures? We can certainly imagine extraterrestrial life that doesn't depend on legged locomotion, but intelligent life, life capable of achieving technology along the same lines as the human model. You know, we've gone into this a bit in the past discussing the notion of, say, a hypothetical aquatic species and what sort of technology they might be able to develop. As technology entails the manipulation of matter, one would need some sort of limbs of manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, terrestrial nature provides us with other forms of manipulation beyond our hands and our arms. They're the arms and tentacles of cephalopods. One could maybe turn to pseudopods and other organisms. Those are not used for tool use, but if we're just imagining some sort of an organism manipulating things, I think pseudopods are on the table.
I just had a crazy idea. What about a magnetic organism? Like it's got like a skin surface that can manipulate things by changing magnetic attraction.
Or it's picked up. I mean, there are animals in the natural world that that utilize magnetism to a certain extent, right? So
yeah.
Maybe there's something there. But when we try and think of tool users that engage in tool use without engaging in bipedal movement, well, you know, a few varieties of octopus come to mind. We can think of dolphins. And we, of course, do see a lot of bipedal use in apes, in birds. But then we have these animals that engage in tool use via their mouth parts or, in the case of elephants, with their trunks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ian M. Banks, the sci-fi writer, he actually explored this idea in his excellent novel Surface Detail. There are these creatures called the Pavulians, and they're like an elephant-like quadrupedal species, but they have a pair of trunks that they use for tool use and computer interface in the front.
Mm.
Now, I was looking around for any writings on this subject, and I ran across this paper, Some Engineering Considerations on the Controversial Issue of Humanoids, by Giancarlo Ginta, from the Department of Mechanics, and this is from the Politecnico di Torino. And this was collected in Cellular Origin, Life in Extreme Habitats and Astrobiology 2015. And Ginta actually lays out much of what I said concerning possible mobility methods and more in a very succinct way. He writes, quote, "Mobility of a living being is strictly linked with how it gets its food and energy. Autotrophic beings may not need any sort of mobility, while heterotrophic ones, and particularly predators, usually need to move to obtain food. Large animals either are supported on a solid surface, float in a fluid under the effect of hydrostatic forces, or fly using aerodynamic forces. Very small beings may use other supporting mechanisms, like surface tension, molecular interactions, etc. Since it is likely that an intelligent being has a minimum size larger than allowing to use these mechanisms, they will not be considered. Other solutions, like magnetic levitation or jets, are conceivable but are quite hypothetical and will not be considered.
Okay.
And he goes on to point out that most animals on solid surfaces do have legs, and that evolution on our planet, at least, is characterized by a gradual reduction in the number of legs. He continues, quote, "In general, the larger is the animal and the lower is the gravity of the planet, the easier it is to remain in equilibrium on a small number of legs, in the sense that the response of the nervous system to avoid falling down may be less quick. From this point of view, low gravity simplifies all operations related to motion." They go on to point out that the speed is important. The speed, of course, is important for survival and is an important factor in natural selection. And we can see this reflected in our dinosaur examples, right? Our prehistoric creature examples, because something like the T-Rex is running quickly to catch prey, as are its theropod kin. And then that earlier example, the kind of weird lizard herbivore, that would have conceivably been running to escape from predators.
Seems another example where so much in evolution ends up having to do with speed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when we talked about the ideas behind what caused the Cambrian explosion, you know, this is another big open question in paleontology and the history of biology and evolution. And one of the ideas there is that maybe suddenly the introduction of predation into the food chain drove an explosion in body plan adaptation, because suddenly things needed to protect themselves and move quickly in order to survive, or in order to – well, it'd still be in order to survive – to catch or evade predation.
Indeed. So Genta continues and says that all of this means there will be, quote, "a strong incentive to shift from walking, a sequel of static equilibrium positions, to running, which includes positions in which static equilibrium is not guaranteed. Large animals, possibly with a smaller number of legs, may have then an advantage, and bipeds are a very good configuration for beings having an adequate control system."
This is interesting. So he's pointing out how one of the features of running is that you can be off balance while you're running, because it's the same way like a bicycle works. You know,
yeah.
A bicycle works because by maintaining speed, you could do this thing that you couldn't stay balanced at a lower speed.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the T-Rex, ideally that herbivore is going to break your fall and you're going to do it with the mouth wide open, right? They also touch on the fact that tool use and manipulation amounts to a shortcut in evolution. Quote, "objects that increase the potentialities of its body, working like prostheses. Why slowly augment your body over the course of, you know, long stretches of time when you can do something like this within a lifetime via tool use?"
Yeah.
So they conclude that such an alien, if we're trying to imagine an alien emerging on another world, that it would need to have some sort of locomotion and some sort of manipulation organs. Quote, "the latter being best derived from locomotion organs like legs. The humanoid layout with two arms and two legs seems to be optimal."
This is an interesting point. Yeah, I would have maybe said, okay, who knows how many legs an alien we encounter might have. But if it's moving around on land, I think this is some pretty solid reasoning. There tends to be evolution toward fewer numbers of legs over time to increase speed, and that this can free up other limbs for tool use, which seems to be an important part of tool-using intelligence. Like you wouldn't need tool-using intelligence if you didn't have hands to use tools with.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting paper. I'm sure there's some astrobiologists and biologists that might – evolutionary biologists that may take issue with this. But I think the author makes an interesting argument here. And it also, as much as I love multi-legged aliens in my sci-fi, it also gives me a little support for visions of bipedal aliens being the dominant form in so many different science fiction visions.
Now, this also makes me question what unexamined assumptions are we bringing on board that could be clouding our vision right here? We're thinking, okay, I'm just trying to universalize about like the physics of planets and the principles of evolution and not be, you know, Earth chauvinist. Mm-hmm. But I bet there are ways that we're somehow being Earth chauvinist that we're not noticing.
Right. Yeah, and we haven't even talked about tails. I can easily imagine some sort of an alien creature with a prehensile tail. Mm-hmm. Or who knows, some other prehensile bit of their anatomy that they're able to use for tool use and manipulation.
Well, to bring it back to the T-Rexes, I think we did mention this, but despite the fact that we don't have tails, tails often form an extremely important part of bipedal locomotion. Mm-hmm. The tails are there to counter as a counterweight for the front of the body. If you've only got two legs and you're like a T-Rex, you're leaning forward. You know, you saw these old pictures where people used to illustrate T-Rexes with their tails dragging on the ground. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. They of course, had to have their tails up in the air as a counterweight to the body so they could move.
Yeah, I am also reminded of kangaroos who have, will engage in bipedal gaits, and their tail is often utilized as a third limb.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a whole bunch that we could do there. I also have to say there's a whole episode we should probably record on just bipedal robots and the attempt to create functional bipedal robots and perhaps getting into the idea of why we want to do it as well.
Because they've got to be like us.
Got to be like us.
We got to create a mechanical man.
Yes. So we'll inevitably come back to that topic in a future episode. But for now, there you have it. Bipedalism, something we do, something other organisms do, something organisms have been doing on this planet for a very long time. And conceivably, there could be other bipeds out there in the universe doing their thing as well. Now, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, links out to our social media accounts, a store tab for our TeePublic store where you can find all sorts of cool designs, including the new squirrel shirt that we have. This is the squirrels are not what they seem, because they're not, if you remember our squirrel episode. Get that on a shirt or a sticker. It's a great way to support the show. And if you want to support the show in a way that doesn't cost you a dime, just simply rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. And don't forget about Invention, the Invention podcast, the new show that Joe and I have put out, coming out every Monday, about human techno history and the power of invention.
Big thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.